Welcome back to Back in My Play. This is episode number 18. This episode, we're going to be talking about Mylon's Secret Castle. I'm Kevin Larrabee, and along with me this week, first off, our special guest, Jonathan Metz of Nintendo World Report and host of Radio Free Nintendo Podcast, one of the hosts. You can catch him also on Twitter at Johnny Metz.
Hi, thank you for having me. Thank you for playing this game.
I know there's someone else on the call too, but before we go any further, prerequisite material. I did not pick this game. Josh did not pick this game. Jonathan picked this game, and I think it's a good game to pick because it will lead to some interesting discussion, like Josh said. But like I mentioned, the third Skype chair is Joshua Hillier, who has a brand new book out on Amazon.com, newly published. You're going to have to make sure to talk a little bit about that too as well, Josh, before we go any further. I'm interested. I actually bought the book.
Oh, wow. Thank you very much. I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
The book is called Train of Thought, and it's a sci-fi book, which is kind of a weird endeavor for me since I don't normally read sci-fi all that much, but I've certainly had my experiences with the genre, and it was just the best way for me to write what it feels like to be stuck in your head all the time was in the context of sci-fi and an alien powering a train through his mental processing. So Train of Thought's the name. I'd encourage you guys to read it. I think you can get it for free actually right now as part of a promotional deal I'm doing with Amazon.
What?
If you're on Prime, I think you can get it for free, like through the lending library. But if not, it's only $2.99, which isn't a lot to ask.
Very inexpensive.
Any kind of kickback from the lending library?
I do. It's not huge. It's a lot smaller than like a direct sell of the book. But yes, I do get some kickback at the end of the month. It depends on how many people check out books and how many people check out my book as well. So those two things kind of come into play.
Okay. So I won't feel like stealing from you if I go get it that way.
No, like apparently last month, $1.2 million worth of lending library money went out there. But I mean, you know, if nobody checked out your
book. Distributed among 1.2 million people.
Yeah, exactly. How many authors were there and who actually had theirs checked out? You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Very cool, man.
No, that's awesome, man. Congratulations. That's a really, really cool accomplishment. It's something I've been thinking about doing for a while now because some of my coworkers and friends have been publishing books lately. And so I'm kind of processing some things in my head right now for ideas.
Yeah, I definitely encourage you to. It's one of the most rewarding things I've gotten to do. So, Kevin, speaking of writing, I wrote an introduction for myself today that I didn't do yet.
Oh, yeah. And by the way, also on the show is Joshua Hillier. Josh, how you doing?
Well, an important aspect of sleeping well at night is wearing the appropriate sleeping attire. I don't know if you guys knew that. For me and for Mylon, that means a long-sleeved pink shirt, bright blue overalls, and a blue nightcap. Once these are in place, I can sleep well.
Super. Bringing it this week, Josh. Mm-hmm. Love it.
I think those are supposed to be magician's clothes.
Ah, see, I got a sleeping attire vibe, but that would make more sense.
It's meant to be kind of, I think it's actually meant to look kind of like Link's cap, you know, his green hood. Or maybe like Merlin from Sword in the Stone.
You got to admit, it has a nightcap sort of look to it, though.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
And before we go any further, Jonathan, I think we should mention yesterday, for people that are listening, well, it depends when you're listening, but on Saturday, you guys actually did like a really cool live podcast talking about F-Zero X and F-Zero GX? Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Just blanket off the top of my head. Really interesting topic because those games are super well loved by the people that love them, but also kind of hard for some people to get into more so on GX. So what was kind of like that show like, and where can people check that out if they want to?
Oh, yeah. It was really fun. We do live shows two or three times a year, including our PAX East panels that we've been doing every year of PAX East since it started. And this one was just online, so we just had a chat room set up and a live audio stream, and we invited people to come hang out and call in and talk to us about these games. And it was a stretch goal from our telethon back in November. That's a whole other topic I could get into. But, I thought it was really – you know, we do this retroactive feature every few months where we all get together and we kind of pick out a few nominees and we let the community vote on which game we should play. Mm-hmm. And they're typically older games. Sometimes they're somewhat newer. We've done like a WiiWare version of it. But for the most part, they tend to be actual retro games. And so a lot of times we at least one or two of us of the four, you know, main colleagues on the podcast end up playing a game that you either have no idea what it's about or you actually just don't like it or have no interest. In this case, we picked the game ourselves, and part of the reasoning behind picking going with F-Zero is just that it's a kind of game that we probably wouldn't normally talk about. You know, it's just, it's a racing game. It's a little bit harder to structure a conversation about it, mm-hmm. but we felt these games were, you know, weird enough and controversial enough that, you know, that it would kind of work. And I thought it went really well, and it ended up being a lot of comparing and contrast, and we actually talked quite a bit about the original F-Zero as well, because I think that provides a nice context for mm-hmm. what the later games did. But yeah, there's definitely mixed reactions, including from just our listeners who played the games and called in and said, I hate GX. You know, I mean, GX is in particular kind of a very inaccessible game. It's got really weird difficulty balancing. So,
well, you guys were talking about even on the easiest difficulty, like it is impossible after the first stage for a lot of people.
I think, well, the story mode is, although one of the things that I think we all agreed on is that the story mode is maybe not the central mode of the game, although, you know, we're kind of trained to think that way a lot of times in modern video games. Mm-hmm. In that game, I think the story mode is really kind of a bonus challenge thing, and you should really focus on the Grand Prix. And that is easier to get into, but it's easy to get hung up on the parts of the game that are just so brutal. Anyway, we recorded all of that, the whole live show, and that will probably be up by the time you hear this. So you can find that on iTunes if you search for Radio Free Nintendo, or you can go over to NintendoWorldReport.com, and it'll be on the front page there as well, or click on the podcast link.
Very cool. And also, Josh was on there, so you can get a
little. Yeah, that's right. Josh called in, which was awesome, and we did a little promo for this show, and we talked about a little F-Zero.
Perfect.
Synergy. And I made a weird reference to Persona and then got kicked off the call, probably.
Yeah, I saw that on Twitter and I just kind of...
No, I thought it was funny. It was my time to leave anyway. I understood that. But it was funny timing, though.
You weren't kicked off at all.
I know.
No, we don't do that.
It was just funny timing. That I was thinking about that more last night, and like I think that F-Zero would, that universe is just so ripe for some sort of like relationship building aspect between races and stuff like that.
I really like the idea of kind of a pro wrestling game or even just a fighting game with all the F-Zero characters, because they really character designs look like pro wrestlers more than race car drivers. And they're very kind of gaudy and just weird, you know, strange get-ups on all these guys. They have really bright colored clothing and they're all big and muscular. And I just think it would be really cool to get all those characters together. I mean, we've seen it a little bit with Captain Falcon, obviously, in Smash Brothers. Mm-hmm. But I could see them going a lot farther with that. Unfortunately, the franchise is pretty much dead. I mean, Miyamoto doesn't like it. It hasn't sold well in the past couple of games. So I don't know if they'll ever bring it back. But if they do, I think there's a lot of potential, a lot of different directions you could go.
That's what I was going to say. If, you know, you guys want a new game, first Nintendo has to want to make a new game.
Right.
I don't know what it is. But we're here to talk about Mylon Secret Castle. So we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with the history of Mylon Secret Castle. We're going to be going in depth with Johnny Metz. So stick around. We'll be right back. Okay, we're here to talk about the history of Mylon Secret Castle. I'm going to do a brief thing, but to be honest, Johnny got in most of the info. You'll probably learn very soon that he loves this game, so I'm going to let him take a lot of the reins for this part. But the release date in Japan, we just got kind of like a general 1986. It was not really one of the first Famicom games over there. It was one of the later ones. And then we got it 2 years later in North America in September 1988. It was developed by Hudson Soft and, as Johnny pointed out, now published by Konami. And for some interesting ports, it was out on the Game Boy in Japan on March 26, 1993, and a little bit later in the U.S. And then also,
I have a copy of that actually from my friend TYP, the younger plumber.
And it has some slowdown issues, right?
You know, I actually never really spent much time playing it. I mean, it was almost like a gag gift from him. Because he knew of my weird affection for Island Seeker Castle, so it's kind of a collector's item. But I haven't really spent much time playing it.
Well, fill me in on kind of like the rest. I mean, really, there wasn't a ton that I could find on the history of this game, especially on the development side. Like, that is a lot of times the most interesting part about this segment is to, you know, find out, you know, the crazy people that worked on this game, then later went on to make these other fantastic games. I wasn't able to find a lot of that stuff. The only kind of interesting tidbit was in 96 that a Super Famicom spinoff / sequel to the game was released, but just in Japan. And then you added, was released as an import title on the Virtual Console, and that it plays very different. But fill me in on the rest of the backstory with this game. And, you know, after this segment, we'll then go into kind of your own personal history with it.
Yeah, sure. I mean, unfortunately, I can't give you a lot of details. I haven't done a ton of digging into the development history of this game. And, you know, I mean, being released in Japan in 86, you can imagine that it was kind of a mid-era Famicom game, but a very early NES game over here in the West. And from what I can tell, it was fairly popular in Japan, and it's kind of, you know, it's a fairly common nostalgic game for people in Japan. Not at all the case in America. I would guess not in Europe either. And I think it was released in a time when we didn't have very much information about games. And because the game in the West doesn't really have much of a following, I don't think there's been a whole lot of research into it over the years. Like you have, like, you know, you guys talked extensively with CJ about the history of Super Mario Brothers 2. But that is a Mario game that sold a bajillion copies. So there's going to be a lot more documentation on it. And a game like this, you know, in Japan, there may very well be quite a bit of information out there that I wouldn't have access to, but in English, I've never found very much info on it at all.
Yeah. And it
seems to just be kind of a quirky relic of the era that, you know, a few people played, they rented it or they got it as a gift, like, which was the case for me. And, you know, I never knew the slightest thing about it until years and years later when I found out, you know, it came from Japan and there was a, you know, a Super Nintendo kind of sequel to it. But really, this is a game that I knew only from personal experience for a very, very long time. And I knew almost no one else who'd ever even played it.
So in terms of you did add some interesting stuff there in terms of the trivia. I think that'd be cool to go over if you want to go over some of that stuff.
Oh, the trivia? Sure. just some things I found. There are levels in the game. There's one level in particular that's kind of known as the Hudson level, where Hudson, the developer, they inserted the name of their company into the level design, and it's actually made up of all these blocks. Some of them you can break with your attack and find secrets in there. And actually, if you follow from left to right the name of the company at the end of the word, it actually kind of leads you to a very important secret area. There are music boxes hidden throughout the game. I don't know if you guys found any because they're sort of arbitrarily placed. You have to bump your head into platforms above. And if you just kind of happen to guess where one might be, this music box will appear. And when you touch it, you go into a mini game where you're running around collecting notes that are thrown up into the air, and you can get some bonus money that way. And the cool thing is there's these characters at the top. This ties into the story as I vaguely recall from the instruction manual when I was a kid. But there are these musicians at the top, and some of them appear to be sort of sleeping or they're not really doing anything, but some of them will have a music instrument and they're playing, and you hear this kind of, it's like kind of like a fife and drum sort of little ditty that plays during the mini game. And the cool thing is, as you play through the game, if you find several of these music boxes, every time you get a new one, the music changes. They add a new instrument to it. And so I think in the story, it's something about these are like sacred instruments of the realm that had been sealed away by a curse. And as you find the music boxes, you're freeing them one by one. And so by the end of the game, when you have all of them unlocked, the song that plays during that bonus game is really cool. It's like very lush and complex for early NES music. But in the beginning, it just sounds like kind of a very basic drum beat. So I just thought that was just a really cool thing. It really gives you a sense of progression as you play through the game, even though that whole thing is kind of a bonus quest along the side. I've always thought it was interesting that this game was released on a lot of different platforms. It's been released over and over and over again, even though no one seems to like it other than me. You know, very few people I talk to have any affection whatsoever. I think Frank Provo from GameSpot has called it like a terrible game, like one of the worst NES games. And I know quite a lot of people have tried it and they get very frustrated with it and they they don't really have anything good to say about it. So it's weird that the game keeps getting released on new platforms and most recently on 3DS Virtual Console back in, I think, October of last year. So there's no matter what platform you own, there's probably a way to play Myelin Secret Castle on there if you're so inclined.
I have to imagine that the licensing rights for Myelin Secret Castle cannot be super expensive.
It's not so much that. I mean, the IP is owned by Konami now. They sort of absorbed Hudson a few years ago. They had some kind of stake in them for a long time, but eventually Hudson started not doing so well, and Konami ended up buying the rest of the shares.
Yeah, it's a huge bummer, man. That was kind of...
Yeah,
that's a really huge bummer, story. Man. For bomber men,
Josh is the king of that.
Yeah, thank you. Lob that one up for me.
Thanks.
Yeah, so I don't think the licensing rights are any issue whatsoever for Konami, and Konami actually really. It seems like lately they release their old games about as much as they work on new games. So yeah. They're quite happy to exploit that back catalog. I think probably one of the reasons it's released so often is that it is an early Famicom/NES game. So it doesn't use any weird programming tricks or special chips or anything like that. So it probably runs really well on the emulators that Nintendo does for Virtual Console. And it's just relatively easy to get it running well.
And you did mention as well, we kind of talked about this in the initial emails about this game, that it was featured on Game Center CX with the Cacho, Chief Arino, actually making it all the way through the game. And you noted that Arino says, quote, considered a masterpiece. And the narrator mentions it was the most requested game on the show's homepage. And I think that's because they knew the guy was going to freak out when he played this game, and he was going to make those mistakes, like forgetting to put in the continue code, which he's done in multiple games. so it is fun to watch it because it's just exhausting for him to play that game at times. And even it seems in Japanese, it was still a confusing game, not even having to deal right. with the rough English translation.
Yeah, and the translation really is quite bad in English, and it can cause some problems as you play through the game. That's why I always recommend people don't be shy to try a guide online if you get stuck in this game, because you probably will. Mm-hmm. And it's just it's very obtuse. Partly that's technical limitations, translation limitations, etc. But I haven't watched the entire Game Center CX video, but I know in the beginning he's actually pretty happy about playing this game because he mentions that he owned it when he was younger and that he's beaten it before and he's quite familiar with it. You can actually see in the early stages as he's playing through, he seems to remember where a lot of things are and generally has a sense of how to progress through the game, which is no easy feat. Mm-hmm. It's a very non-linear game, and I think when you first play it, it's not clear at all what you're supposed to do or how you're supposed to make any kind of progress. So if you have even kind of a vague sense of where to go first, where to go next, I think that can sort of get you off to a running start and help you move through the game. And that's how I've been able to go back to it many times over the years. And I don't always remember the details of where every single little thing is, but I have a pretty good sense of what I'm supposed to be doing. And I think, that's a big advantage in playing a game like this. If you're coming to it completely cold, it's going to be pretty frustrating in the beginning, especially because the game is very heavily predicated on secrets. I mean, it's right there in the title, but There are little, sometimes very minor things, sometimes very major things hidden all over this game, and kind of like in, you know, kind of like a game like Metroid maybe, or even Zelda, these are not optional bonus things that are off to the side that you may or may not find. They're quite often in the critical path for playing the game. So you really have to go around and test all the walls and really be thorough and try to, you know, just try all kinds of things and see what works, see what doesn't work, or else you'll never get through this game.
Well, let's take a quick break. Then we're going to come back and talk about, I guess, our memories. And specifically, we're going to be talking about Johnny's memories. I'm interested to hear his history with this game and why he would pick this. So trust me, you're going to want to stick around. We'll be back in just a second. Back with our personal memories and history of the game, and not just because you're our special guest, but because you picked the game personally, and you said even earlier that you enjoy this game, you have fond memories of this game. So tell me, what was your history with this game? How did you get it, and how did you grow to like it and love it?
Well, actually, before I do that, I want to ask real quickly, had either of you guys ever played this before?
Probably on like a friend's NES, and it's like 3 seconds later, I was like, no, because it was a puzzle game and I wasn't shooting people and I was blowing bubbles. And the only bubble game I liked was Bobble Bubble. So that was it.
Yeah, I did play it as a kid. I rented it. I know that's my story for like every game, but I rented a lot of games back then.
I did a lot of renting money. Too when I was a kid.
Yeah, but I remember it. I thought the box art looked really cool.
You know what? Mm-hmm. I got on NeoGAF in our thread, I got yelled at for saying that I rented every game like that we've talked about on the
you
show.
Did.
He's only rented The Legend of Zelda. He didn't even buy it when it came out. I'm like, dude, it came out when I was 0 years old. I was zero. So I did not buy it. And also my parents like kind of we were kind of poor. So we couldn't really buy NES games. I'm surprised that we even had an NES. But anyways, renting is okay. It's okay to do that.
Dude, your memories weren't pure,
totally.
Okay?
Yeah.
I think hardly anyone rents games nowadays, but also with the download platforms, it's possible to get games for such lower prices that you can have a diverse and deep library without having to rent a lot of games, you know, and physical rental stores have mostly gone away anyway. So
Gamefly's all right. If you guys ever want to jump on Gamefly, I've had success with them in the past, but I don't really play new stuff anymore. So.
Yeah, I used to have Gamefly and I really liked it, but ultimately what I found is that I wasn't playing those discs because I was downloading so many games and playing those all the time.
Yeah.
I felt almost obligated to play the game on disc from Gamefly just so I wasn't wasting my subscription. And ultimately I was just, you know, I've got enough of a backlog without paying someone to make it worse.
Exactly. Yeah, I hear you.
But it wasn't anything to do with their service. I enjoyed it. All right, so you know, Josh, I don't know what memories you have. Maybe we could get into that. But for me, it's one of those games that I don't actually remember exactly how we got it, which means that probably my parents bought it for Christmas for us, for my sister and I, as just kind of you know, they walked in the store, they didn't ask us, they just looked around and saw what was out there and whatever. Maybe it was the box art, or maybe it was a little bit cheaper, but they picked up this game, and so. As far as I can tell, it was probably a Christmas gift or a birthday gift. And I just remember one day we got it and, you know, started playing it and really knew nothing else about it. You know, I mean, it had very little coverage in Nintendo Power. I think it was a little early for that magazine to have a lot of coverage of it.
Yeah, because we're talking about 1987, right?
Yeah, well, it was like 80. The copyright says 87, but it didn't actually come out until 88. So I don't know what's up with that. But that was still like in the very early days of Nintendo Power. And I remember, because this game is so confusing and mysterious and very difficult, I remember always looking for coverage of the game in Nintendo Power. But, you know, as the years went on, it just seemed inevitable that it was never going to happen. I think the only thing they ever had was in a classified information, that the cheat section, they had the continue code, which I think is also in the instruction manual. I know it is in the Japanese version, because you can see Reno looking it up. So never got a whole lot of help from Nintendo Power on this. And outside of that, you know, none of my friends had ever played it. I would show it to them, and some of them thought it was interesting, some of them didn't. But, you know, there was really nowhere to go for help. So over the years, you know, we never had a ton of games around, so we would spend a lot of time with the ones that we had. And this is a game that you can spend a lot of time with. You can really kind of test the levels and try to figure out what the heck is going on. And for that reason, I always found it was a really nice challenge. You know, it's not super obvious what you're even supposed to be doing in this game. So for me, it was exciting to turn it on, run around the levels. It got to where I knew the first couple levels, like, you know, could probably play them with my eyes closed. But then I'd never gotten much farther than that. And then, you know, one day my sister would be playing it maybe, and she'd say, "Hey, come look at this. I think I found something." You know, and I think the first breakthrough was when we found that in the very first level, there's a block. There's a row of three blocks, and if you blast the ones on the left and right with your bubbles, they go away, and it leaves the block in the middle. And then if you push on that block, it'll move to the side, and it makes kind of a cool sound effect when it does it. And it maybe is a clue, something significant just happened. Mm-hmm. And then if you shoot the space where that block was originally, a door will appear, and it takes you to a shop where you can buy an item that lets you proceed. So there's no visual indication that this should be possible. I don't think there's anything in the manual that tells you you can push blocks. It's just something that, you know, maybe we did it accidentally, or maybe we're just really desperate and we're just trying everything. But it's the kind of game where the desperation will drive you to discover the game's secrets, because you really do have to push on every little thing and shoot at every single tile.
Right.
It gave me a sense of every level being kind of a puzzle, you know, that I always felt there was an intelligence behind these levels, and that someone had really put a lot of thought about where to place all these different items, where to put the secrets, how are they going to get you to try to do that thing. And it was the early days of game design. So a lot of that stuff, it comes across as being very obtuse now. And if you grew up maybe more spoiled on something like Super Metroid, which has this very sublime method of leading you to the next thing, and it never tells you what to do, but it kind of takes you to a place where doing the right thing is the only way you can ever possibly get out of there. Mm-hmm. It's very smart about that kind of thing. And My Own Secret Castle is a little more crude than that. But it really does encourage you to explore and to try new things, and that always was very appealing to me, even when I was very young. And to this day, it's the kind of game that I enjoy the most, is where you kind of get a world where it's mysterious and you don't really know how to navigate it, but all you can do is go around and try things. And when you try things, surprising things happen. And over the course of doing that over and over, you start to get a sense of, like, you discover the rules of the world and you discover the progression on your own. And My Own Secret Castle, I think, is probably a big reason that I feel that way about games nowadays, just because I had little choice but to keep going back to it and trying new things over and over until we finally got something that worked. So I played it off and on for years, you know, on the NES. It was just always a game that we had around, and it was always this open-ended, incomplete challenge. So I would go back to it and try more things, and it got to the point where I could get pretty deep into the game. But I never did beat it until many years later, when they released it on the Wii Virtual Console. And you know, it's funny, because at that point I had finally started to get the sense that actually most people don't like this game, and that I was kind of weird for enjoying it, just because I had all these great childhood memories of plowing through it, and getting very frustrated. I mean, not all happy memories, trust me. It's like I said, it's a really hard game, even if you do know what you're doing. But when it came out on Wii Virtual Console, like probably around 2007, again, it was fairly early release on that service. Mm-hmm. I didn't hesitate at all to download it and play through it. And I probably got as far as I'd ever gotten. And then I looked online and kind of got a little more information, because, you know, GameFAQs didn't exist when I had originally played this as a kid. So I went to that and I learned a little bit more about it. And especially thanks to the save states on Wii, where you can kind of suspend and always come back to it, and you don't have to play through the whole game in one session, I was finally able to beat the game. So, you know, at the ripe age of 25 years old, probably, I finally completed My Own Secret Castle, and I felt really good about it. And that's when I think the moment when it really cemented for me that, yeah, I really do appreciate this game a lot and I have a lot to say about it and no one wants to listen because everyone else hates it.
One thing I wanted to ask you in listening to, you know, you're talking about this as an open-ended experience for years on end, and part of that being an aspect of the design and how it's obtuse, like you were saying. When you first played it, like as a kid, how familiar were you with the conventions of 2D platformer games?
Well, not at all. I mean, I probably got this game less than a year after we got Super Mario Brothers.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and I think that's important, though. I think that's important to not already have all the conventions of how a 2D Metroid-esque game where you can go to different areas in a non-linear fashion, mm-hmm. to where you don't have those conventions already cemented in your brain, but instead this is just another game, you know, and it doesn't matter what the conventions are because the conventions are still being established because it's the 80s and this is the Wild West of video games.
Well, that was the cool thing though, right? Back in the day when we had NESs, almost every single game that came out, it was just brand new ideas, and you were just kind of dropped in a world, not a lot of explanation, not a lot of help. Maybe you look in the instruction manual if you're lucky, you'll get some tips, but you're basically just go figure it out, kid.
Yeah, and it's incredible, especially, you just said, in that sort of joking manner, go figure it out, kid. But the kid part's especially true because all three of us were playing this stuff as kids, and that's the task we were given. It's not like we bought this game because, oh, it's a platformer and I love platformers like we would today. It was, Mylan's Secret Castle is now in my life for whatever reason. Somebody in my family handed me this game, so it exists.
Well, it might be the only game you get for the next 6 months.
Right.
So you better find a way to enjoy it.
That's the point that stuck with me. When you said that, I'm like, all right, I can understand because we got Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and we were stuck with that for like the next 6 or 8 months or a year. And you just, you play it over and over and over again and you kind of figure out how to even, disarm all those damn bombs at the dam. And you figure out how to just keep going forward. And it's probably why we built up those skills, those 8-bit skills as kids growing up, because you had no choice. Like, you didn't have Game Genies yet. You just had to kind of figure it out. Maybe you had Nintendo Power for a little bit of help, but you had to just keep going, keep busting your head up against that wall until you, cracked it enough to get through. But you're making good points. I'm appreciating your argument now.
Oh, good. Well, let me completely lose you because I'm going to go into Mylan Defense Force here.
Uh-oh.
I played a lot of NES games when I was a kid. Like Josh, I rented a lot. That was very common for us to go rent games because we didn't get to buy them very often. And usually rented them just kind of on a whim, or maybe it was just one of the only games at the store we hadn't already rented 3 times.
Yep.
So we would play just kind of random stuff all the time. And so I have nostalgia for lots and lots and lots of different games. A lot of them I've gone back to thanks to things like Virtual Console years later and found out that they don't necessarily hold up that well. And I'm actually going to come out and say, I think Mylan's Secret Castle holds up really well. And, for me, it's not just because I own the game and I had to play it a lot. I go back to it and in a lot of ways, I find that there's something kind of sublime and very, very challenging, but in a thoughtful way about this game that I would not say about something like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which I also played a ton of as a kid and now look back and say, actually, that's really not a good game.
Whoa.
And I've gone back and played it and not had any fun with it at all. So I think Mylan's Secret Castle, it holds up in part because it is so nonlinear. It is so strange. It is so discoverable. And when I compare it to a game like Metroid, I'm not just trying to be ingratiating. I think that's a really important comparison and a really good thing to keep in mind because, especially as a kid back in, 88, 89, there weren't a lot of games like that around. And I had played Metroid and I'd seen people play it a lot. So I was very familiar with the structure of that game. And Mylan's Secret Castle is an action game in which your main attack is a limited range projectile that you can shoot at multiple angles and multiple directions. You use it to break blocks and find secret passageways from one screen to the next. You upgrade your abilities over the course of the game. They're not just given to you as you proceed, but you actually have to find these things, and they can significantly change the way that you move, the way that you attack, the places that you're allowed to go. And the game really has a sense of you exploring a space with very little direction from anyone or anything as to which direction you should go. A lot of times you have multiple choices about how you can approach something or which way you might go next, including stages that scroll both up and, you know, basically in all four directions, which was pretty unusual at the time. You know, like if you go back to Super Mario Brothers, all the levels in that game scroll left to right, with no exception. And then I was surprised you guys didn't talk about this more with CJ, but one of the best things about Mario Brothers 2 is that they have levels that scroll up and down. And there's actually one of my favorite levels. You start out in Mario 2, you start out in a waterfall, and the first three or four screens of that level, you're just kind of falling. And it, you know, right. There's not, it's more of a showpiece than anything, but it's a really great example of the technology upgrades that they'd done since the first Super Mario Brothers.
I will give you a great reason why we didn't discuss that is because every time you switch from each screen, it pauses briefly for a second, and I find that super annoying.
It does, and Mylan Secret Castle doesn't do that. The level actually scrolls with you. And it's actually a little more freeform than even than Metroid, because in Metroid, basically the levels either go left and right or they go up and down, but never both. And in Mylan Secret Castle, I mean, the very first level of the game, you pop into it, and it's basically this huge sort of vertical rectangular thing that's larger than the screen, and you can scroll in any direction. And that was pretty sophisticated level design back then, and not many games could even pull that off technically.
Do you like?
So I think for a lot of reasons, this game actually does hold up. It's a very, very, it's at least, I hope, a strong curiosity for people.
Do you like the combat?
You know, early on.
Because you compare it to Metroid, which I don't think Metroid has very good combat either. At least, no, the original Metroid.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, though they're very similar in a lot of ways, because you have enemies a lot of times that are attached to walls, or they're moving around in ways that are really, they're not really reacting to you. Mm-hmm. They might be shooting projectiles at you, and those are the hardest enemies by far. Anything that shoots projectiles in this game is just a real bastard. But most of the enemies just kind of crawl back and forth, you know, oblivious to your presence. Some of them bounce around in patterns that are a little bit difficult to predict, and I really like those because they keep you on your toes. And you know, I think the fact that you can shoot the bubbles either upward or downward, it adds a lot to the combat, because you kind of have to think about, in a lot of cases, you want to be in the air because you can adjust your direction more easily when you're in the air. And on the ground, it's tricky because there's no run button in this game, because you do shoot. So unlike Mario, there's no separate run button. So the way they handle it is basically purely on momentum.
Right.
And from a standing start, you'll move very slowly, but the longer you keep moving in one direction, the faster he'll go, and he'll accelerate up to a limit. And once you get to that limit, you can use jumps to basically change direction without losing your speed. And it's a very important skill, especially in the boss encounters, which I think managing your momentum to dodge the shots but also stay within range of the boss you can attack is very important and pretty tricky to do, because you don't have a lot of space to run around in. I think there's a lot of subtleties to the combat that maybe aren't obvious when you first turn on the game. If you haven't played it for a few hours, you might have a hard time getting a hang of it. But again, I mean, you know, if you listen to Radio Free Nintendo, I think you'll probably find this is a strong pattern in the games that I really like, and the kind of like action platformers that I like. They tend to be games where they have unorthodox methods of transportation, like grappling hooks, jetpacks, you know, running along the walls, curling up into balls like in Metroid, things like that, that they really make you rethink how you move around the environment and how you engage with not only the platforms but also the enemies. So, yeah, I do like the combat in this game.
Kevin, how do you feel about it? You brought that up, so I'm thinking that you probably disagree on the subject.
I'm going to wait until the next segment just to keep in timeline segments.
Very good. Very good.
Anything else in terms of the history, our personal history with this game, that you guys want to bring up before we move on?
I just want to say that this is a game that deserves to be commended for its box art, because it did attract me.
Really?
You know, it looks mysterious. Yeah, look at this castle. Like, I thought it was a horror game. It actually does have some kind of frightening moments, which I'm going to talk about that in my...
Frightening moments.
Sure, I mean... When you're outside the castle and the lightning bolts start coming at you and you have like one hit point left,
yes,
that's terrifying. And that's actually insinuated by the box art, because you have the bolts of lightning around the castle.
For the record, Josh did not say terrifying once when we played Dracula X, Rondo of Blood. But Mylon's secret castle terrifies him. So just keep that for reference as we go into the future of this podcast.
I was more fearless as a child, I think. And I played Castlevania games more as a kid. So yeah, that must be it.
Did you see how big Dracula got in his second form?
Oh, yeah. Don't get me wrong. I squealed a bit.
Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back and we'll talk about playing this game for the first time or replaying it. So stick around. It's going to get interesting. Okay, we're back, and I don't know who Josh, you can go first, man. I have the stuff that I have written down. I've attempted to play this. Actually, I'll just go first because I'm going to get this out.
Yeah, you need to say it. I can tell.
All right. I sat down. I made three planned attempts to play this game, and first was Wednesday night. Then again, I think it was Friday night, and this morning on Sunday, I again attempted to play through this game, get in a groove, see the brilliance in this game that I've heard so much about, and I hate this game. I really don't like it, and I will try to give my reasons as best I can, but first off, it's a pixel hunt. For me, like when I was looking at it, go ahead, Josh, if you want to.
No, I just want to say this is something that Johnny retweeted a few hours ago, and it was a post that you made on NeoGAF, Kevin, and I think this is relevant before you go into talking about the pixel hunt and all that.
Yeah.
Kevin Larrabee says on NeoGAF, I'm trying so hard to like Mylon's Secret Castle. I want to put this NES cart over an open flame.
No, I did it. Not to that extent, but I took it out of my NES and I threw it across the room because I made a and for everyone that loves Virtual Console, this game cost me $4.50 with free shipping on eBay. So I made like a bandit on that because I can also throw it. You can't throw a Virtual Console game.
It's a good point.
You can throw a Wii remote. It's wireless.
You can throw a Wii remote, but that's a $40 investment that I'm not willing to sacrifice. But along with this game, like I said, I really tried hard because we've played games in the past on the show that were, like, we talked about, like, these hidden gems, like Journey to Silius. And maybe this was just something I wasn't getting. So I just thought, all right, I don't get it this play. This playthrough, I'm not really feeling it. I'm just going to put it down. I'm going to go do something else because I don't want to force myself to really play this game where I'm going to get to the point of disliking it. But the first thing that you run into is, again, you're just kind of dropped in outside of the castle. You go in, and all you really know is that you have your attack and you have your jump. The first thing that bothered me is the movement because you build up momentum as you run. There is no, like, you don't hold down the fire button to go into your running animation like you would a Super Mario Brothers. You just kind of move forward and you have to build up momentum to get speed before you can get going. So that was kind of awkward for me. And then again, with the bubbles, like you said, it's a attack that is not very long. So you kind of have to be up close to enemies to use it. And same thing, when you are looking, and this is the thing, I don't like the mechanics of this game because you have to literally blow bubbles at every single block in every single stage. Otherwise, you might have left something behind. You might not be able to find the key. Like, there are, like, that's not fun to me, and that's not good game design to me, at least today. Like, the main thing that I said when I started doing this podcast, I don't want to play games that I don't like. But I'm always willing to try new games to see if there is something to like in them. So I moved on. You know, I got out of that first stage, and I go into the item shop. And the item shop gives me no help. There's no descriptions for any of the stuff. You're basically just forced to buy stuff to see what it does, which is not super helpful. The hints themselves, also not super helpful because the translation was probably done by like a fifth grader who was, you know, taking English in Japan that they had do the translations. You mentioned the lightning. Why am I getting attacked by lightning when I go outside the castle? Why am I being spooky. Attacked?
It's. There, I think it's actually to encourage you to hurry up and choose a level.
Well, I wanted to. I wanted to try to get into every little window and door. I was just kind of messing around. So that happened. And then also, if you don't know the continue code, which at the beginning, that first playthrough, I was not using. I'm like, I'm just going to try to get through. And I wasn't even far enough to use it anyways. You basically have one life bar. Once your life is gone, you're done. If you find the honeycomb, and luckily I knew where that was from watching Game Center CX, I was able to get that to extend my life. But again, you know, there are times where even in the second room that you go into, the enemy's attacks were just kind of beating me up and I would die and I would have to go all the way back to the beginning and start all over again. So again, not super enjoyable for me. Then when I beat the first boss, this was this morning, I totally forgot to use the continue code. So then I have to go all the way back to the beginning again. And that's when I said, F this game. I'm not playing it anymore because it took me so long because you have to go through just a barrage of stuff to get to this point. I blew bubbles at every single square that I approached up until that point, and I just didn't want to do it again because I didn't remember where everything was, and I was done. Like I tried. I tried three different times. I tried for, I'd probably say like 2.5 hours total, you know, because I could only take about 35, 45 minutes at a time, and then I was done. So I want to say from your talk before, Johnny, I appreciate your love of this game. I appreciate what you're saying, and I can totally see how it would grow on someone and how it would be a very prideful, you know, game to have beaten. And I think that's why in Japan, it might be one of those games like Daraga that people just, that's one of those cult games. Like if you can figure out this game and if you can know it like the back of your hand, like that is a huge, you know, badge of honor or courage or whatever. So I'm sorry, I had to get all that out because I just, after this, I don't know if I'm going to play the game ever again. But at least I know that I don't want to play the game ever again.
Yeah, I think your experience is probably very typical because this is not a game that you will get used to or figure out in the span of a couple hours. And, you know, in this day and age, why would you ever spend more than a couple hours playing a game that you don't enjoy right away? You know, there's too many games available. So, and again, it's not a game where just reading a guide or even watching a video of someone play it is going to make you good at it, because a lot of the skill of playing the game comes in getting used to the handling of it and getting a feel for the timing of the enemy movements and for the range of your shots and you know, the managing your momentum and also, you know, remembering where things are. Like you said, you know, when you forgot to continue, you didn't want to play through that stuff again because you didn't remember where all those pieces are. Well, if you did it a few more times, you know, which is bound to happen if you're a kid playing this and you don't have any other any selection to it. For me, it was as a matter of repetition, I did learn where all those things are. And I, you know, it was probably years before I got very far past the first boss, but I could get to that first boss in the span of maybe 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And if you actually know where the things are, you don't have to spend a lot of time running around shooting at every single block because you've done that before and you know that there's nothing there. So you remember where the things actually are hidden, you get them right away, and you move on. And it really doesn't take that long to get to the boss if you know those things. But, you know, the first time you play it, you're not going to.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I mean, I think your experience is completely valid.
And Johnny, what you're saying, I think, makes sense that a kid, it's sort of a you had to be there kind of game. Mm. And I've been talking about this recently with people who I'm not sure they always wanted to hear me talk about it. I just often talk to people whether they want to or not. And I've been talking about this whole you had to be there experience. And as a kid, you know, you have time to pixel hunt and to look around and test the walls and test different blocks and see what's possible. And that is not quite as prevalent in today's game design, which is sort of the discussion you guys were having. And I agree that Mylan's Secret Castle might be a game that very much falls under the you had to be there under that banner. I'm curious. So, Kevin, you do not like the original Metroid.
Well, I didn't grow up with it. I think Super Metroid is a fantastic game, but it's probably that in the Game Boy, the original Game Boy game, Metroid 2, I love, and the Game Boy Advance games. But those are pretty much the extent of my Metroid love in the series.
Gotcha. Okay. And Johnny, how do you feel about the original Metroid?
Sure. I think the original Metroid is fascinating and, you know, deeply ambitious and tries to do a lot of things that it's not technically capable of. And as a result is, you know, a large chunks of it, I think, are not very fun at all. It's not a game that I really enjoy going back to. I'm so glad they remade it as Zero Mission, which is maybe my favorite Metroid game. But I actually wanted to bring that up because Myland's Secret Castle is a game, obviously you guys wouldn't be surprised to hear this, I would love to get a remake or some kind of sequel to this, like a true sequel, because it is a game that is constrained by the technology of the time. I mean, Kevin, you talked about pixel hunting, and I probably wouldn't go that far, but it you know, because the blocks that you're trying to shoot to look for secrets, they're not pixel size. They're about as almost as big as your character. So you don't have to be excruciatingly, you know, perfect on your on the angle or the, you know, you don't have to shoot at every single little thing, but you want to spray bubbles kind of all over the place to see what blows up and what leads to a new passage. And I think that is really, as you said, I mean, it certainly wouldn't fly in today's game design, but it also doesn't need to, because now we could implement details in the tiles, or you could this is something Super Metroid does a lot. It doesn't always use visual indications to let you know that a block might be bombable, but it will arrange the level in such a way that it kind of leads you in that direction a very subtle, maybe even subconscious way. It's like, you know, I don't know what it is about this room, but I just have a feeling that something must be over there. And it could be because of what else is in the room. It could be because there's apparently nothing in the room.
Or you can't move forward or something like that. You're just
Or you think, why would they put a room here if there's nothing in here? There must be a secret. You know, so that's a level of design sophistication that I don't think was really quite there back when the when Myland's Secret Castle was made. So I again, I really appreciate what they're trying to do with the level designs here and the way that they're, you know, they're trying to encourage you at least to be thorough and to explore and to try things. But they really didn't have the tools to lead you down any particular path. And so I think, you know, if you're going to go back to a game like this, like, I don't know if you guys have played La Mulana, which is a modern game, but it's very retro styled. And it actually owes a lot to games like the original Metroid and to Myland's Secret Castle. But in that game, there's a lot of focus on it's an incredibly difficult game, but there's a lot of little tricks that they do to try to give you hints. And a lot of times you might not even notice the clues until after you die and you go back to it a second time and you say, ah, if I'd really been paying attention or if I'd really thought about the way this room is set up, I probably could have avoided that in the first place, but I'm not trained to do that, you know, by video games in this day and age. So I feel like if you went back and if you had it to do over again, you could probably do a lot of things in a game like this to make it seem more fair and less arbitrary. But at the time, I think they did the best they could.
Yeah, I think that what you're saying makes a lot of sense just in terms of visual cues. And when you think about like the original Legend of Zelda, that's a game that to some extent you would have to try to figure out like, okay, well, where is this next dungeon where there's some secrets, you know, and I'm just going to like bomb some different areas. But once you were within a dungeon, if you found the map, it would be clear sometimes that there must be something on this wall that would allow me to get through to this other passage. So there were some games that proved that it could be done back then, but then there was stuff like Metroid, which is why I keep bringing up Metroid, that also were very much like Myland's Secret Castle, in terms of being very ambitious and having great ideas, but not really having the tools necessarily, or whether it's the sophistication in game design, like you were talking about, Johnny, to pull that off. But Metroid was really lucky as a franchise that several years later, they happened to make one of the greatest games of all time with the same name attached to it. So people,
well, Metroid also had the benefit of being a first party Nintendo game with extensive coverage in you know, places like Nintendo Power. So there were maps, there were clues, there were walkthroughs for Metroid. And so, you know, I think it's easy to forget that in a vacuum, Metroid is almost impossible.
It really is.
Finding things like the Varia suit, which is hidden in a seal in a secret ceiling room where you go through a very nondescript kind of tunnel passageway, and you have to jump right in the middle, and magically you could go right through the ceiling there. And then there's some hidden blocks behind the foreground there that you have to kind of find and find your way up, except you can't do it unless you have the high jump boot. So you might even do it and think, well, maybe that's just a bug. And you have to go back when you have the high jump boots and get up there, and you finally get up to the red door and get the Varya suit. And that suit is practically required to beat the game, but it's in a very, very difficult to find spot. And that was okay back then because you could call the, you know, Nintendo 800 number for help, or you could open up a Nintendo Power magazine and look at the map. And those kind of resources just weren't as available for third-party games like Myland Secret Castle, which is every bit as obtuse as Metroid.
Absolutely.
Bit.
Well, and it wasn't as big of a third-party release as some either. Right. You know, so yeah, so it didn't have the same sort of coverage. And I just don't think it had as long of a shelf life, you know? Like, I don't think, like, rental stores, for instance, didn't have a ton of copies of it. And yeah, you guys are making a lot of sense here. I'm going to chime in a little bit on just some things that I, because I'm somewhere between the two of you. So that's why I think this discussion's been really interesting. Jonathan or Johnny has this like love for the game.
You enjoyed Kevin, this game, Josh?
No, I wouldn't say I enjoyed it. See, there you go.
Okay.
I Let's fall be real. I fall somewhere between the two of you.
Did you like the music?
I like the music okay.
I'm hanging up. This is done. Last episode of the Back in My Play podcast. This is it.
Okay, let me... I got to talk about the music for a minute because it's so weird.
Let's talk about the 3 minutes of total music that are in the whole game.
I said it was okay. Let me be clear. I'm talking like 5 out of 10.
Love those 15-second loops. The 15-second loops that play over and over again that made me shut off the
Hey, there's a lot of electronic artists that have made a great deal of money off of loops, you know.
What are we doing here?
I think what's great about the music in Myland Secret Castle, it really doesn't sound like anything else on the system. And I think what they were going for... ties into the story of the game. So you would have had to look at the instruction manual to probably read up on this at all, which I had as a kid. So I would read it looking for clues and then find none. But I did get some of the lore behind Myland Secret Castle. And it has to do with music being kind of it's sort of the soul of the people of this land, and they're placed under a curse, and the sacred musical instruments are locked away. So music is very much a part of the mythology of the game. And if you look at the sort of spinoff for Super Famicom, it's called Do Re Mi Fantasy,
which is good game, by the way.
It's very good. It has little to do with Myland Secret Castle, I mean, in terms of gameplay. But you run around collecting music notes, and there's a whole like sub-screen where you can look at all the magical instruments that you've restored. And I think each one of them has like a special power that lets you swim or do a butt stomp or something like that. So it is very much a part of the theme of the game. And so the music, I think, reflects that. And it has a kind of it's almost like a kind of a Celtic flair to it. And some of the compositions are, to me, like going back as an adult and knowing a lot more about music than I did back then, some of the compositions in this sound like they're going for almost like a kind of Baroque kind of composition style, but they're severely limited by the NES Famicom sound chip. So they're trying to pull off very complex kinds of music with very simplistic sound design, sound programming, and it comes off as mostly just being psychedelic and very weird. And I think it also kind of sounds like circus music at times. Mm-hmm. And you know, I just think all of that really adds to the weird, like hallucinatory charm of this game. And the graphics are a big part of that too. The whole game is just very bizarre. And I really like that kind of thing. So, you know, I do have a lot of affinity for the music.
It has a fever dream kind of vibe to it, both aesthetically and musically. Kevin, did you die? Are you still alive?
You talked me off the ledge a little bit. Obviously, since you picked the game, it's really good that we had you on here, because again, not knowing that, giving me some sort of context for why they programmed the music the way they did allows me to at least give it the benefit of the doubt. That I should appreciate it more than I do. But personally, for me, when I'm playing a video game, we talked about this extensively last episode, and I talked about it on Player One, that a big part of enjoying a game is the music, especially in a game that is difficult, that I'm going to be replaying the same levels over and over and over again. It helps me mentally stay composed, because at least I'm enjoying some aspect of the game while I'm potentially being, you know, beaten down by the difficulty or getting lost in The Legend of Zelda, but I can still hear that music that I am enjoying over and over and over again, where in this game, for me personally, again, I thought it was 20-second loops, 30-second loops, and I downloaded the soundtrack for obviously you guys are hearing it in the episode right now, but I was not super impressed. It just sounded like one of those first-run NES games, but I can now appreciate what you're saying. I'm going to try to say that, and you know, at least leave it at that.
I feel like I'm the moderator like a lot here.
Like a lot of aspects in the game, I think it's very ambitious and it's very hampered by the technology and the skill level of the people making the game. So it ends up coming across as just being very odd. Mm-hmm. But if you can kind of pick it apart, and I don't know, I try to put myself in the shoes of the people who made this game. They wanted to make a good game, and it's such a creative, original game. It's not really like anything else that I've played on the system. And I had to think there was a lot of thought put into this and a lot of good intentions that just weren't fully realized. And you know, I think taking that perspective on it, you know, like you said, giving it the benefit of the doubt, has made me over the years, as I've had time to process the ordeal that this game represents in my childhood and over the years of playing it, I think I've gained a lot of appreciation for it as I've gotten older, in a way that I could not have told you most of this stuff as a kid. And I probably would have told you it was not one of my favorite NES games as a kid. I mean, I'm not going to say it's one of my favorite NES games now. I just think it's one of the most interesting NES games. And it's one that I can talk about that a lot of people just don't seem to have any informed opinion of, or they've tried it and honestly just dislike it. So they would never, you know, when you guys gave me sort of carte blanche to suggest a game, I couldn't resist, because I thought, who else are they ever going to have on the podcast who would even, you know, consider talking about this game?
Someone
needs to.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I'm glad that we talked about it today. Kevin put in his 2.5 hours. I probably played the game about that same amount of time before I eventually was like, I've seen a lot of this game. I'm just going to watch the rest of it on YouTube. I'll admit I did that to see how the game ended. But,
at least watch the Game Center CX episode. It's always those episodes, no matter what he's playing, are always enjoyable. And it is cool to kind of at least see the whole game and not just like the first three rooms.
Yeah, it gets really crazy at the end, you know, like with how long you can stay in the air with your jumps and that sort of thing. It's pretty impressive, the things you unlock over time. So I'm right between you guys, though. Like, you know, Johnny loves it. Kevin hates it. I just think it's an okay NES game. Like, I appreciate some of the ideas that were at stake and at play in it. But it was sort of hampered by technological limitations and just understanding of game design, which is the way a lot of 1980s NES stuff is, you know, when you go back and play that stuff, it's like it's almost great. But it just certainly isn't, is how I feel about a lot of it.
Okay, I'm not gonna argue. But it's
like the 16-bit era. You know, if this game had been made in the 16-bit era, which they made a game in the series technically, I just think it would have been so different.
So you need Super Mylon Secret Castle.
Yeah, that's what I want.
My beating heart.
Yeah, I mean, listen to Johnny.
In an alternate universe, like, I'm a big fan of the TV show Fringe. I'm sure in that alternate universe, they had Super Mylon Secret Castle, and it's like that top-tier Super Nintendo game, you know, where Super Metroid didn't exist, but Super Mylon Secret Castle did, and that's the game that everyone goes to when they say, you know, top 3 Super Nintendo games. You got Super Mario World, you got Super Mylon Secret Castle, and Street Fighter II Turbo. Like, those are my three games.
Yeah, and Kurt Cobain is still alive.
He's not. I'm just kidding.
Wait. Oh, okay.
That's right. Bad news for you, Kevin.
What? Oh no. Well, it's also let's not talk about old music. We could talk about mini disc players though sometime.
Pavement's Crooked Rain came out on Valentine's Day 20 years ago. Did you guys know that?
Nice.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Sorry. That's old music.
All right.
That's my old music corner.
Let's take a quick break. We're going to be right back with some more discussion. And this was fun. It was educational, you know, just like in Back to the Future 1. Very educational experience.
Okay.
We'll be right back. Okay, this is the time-sensitive portion of the podcast. So if you're listening to this in 2015, a lot of this stuff might not be relevant anymore. But we are going to be getting into a cool discussion about hidden gems in the NES since we have Johnny on here. The first thing that I want to bring up real quick is I'm going to be giving away this $10 GameStop gift card to the first person that replies to @backinmyplay with your favorite weekend rental episode so far. I have a $10 GameStop gift card. It's actually $10 and like 78 cents. It's what's left on a, it's what's what I have left on a gift card, and I'm giving it to you, that. The fans, because it's about giving back, you know?
You're really re-gifting is what you're doing. What?
No, actually, I got this. Okay, whatever. Yeah. I mean, if you, it's $10 and you have to tweet to Back in My Play and @KevinLarrabee and @JoshHillier and @JohnnyMetz. You get to reply to all of us and make sure you're following all of us and stuff like that. That way we can help build the audience and the, you know, interaction with the fans. So that's that. Also, I want to quickly mention the Neo Geo Omega. We talked about this on last episode with Kurt, but I was really debating picking one of these up. I ended up dropping about $1,000 on Neo Geo stuff in the last week because it was one of those things where if you put your toe into the water, you kind of just have to jump in because it's kind of a big investment to get into this Neo Geo stuff. And
You could pay $5 for Myland Secret Castle or spend hundreds to play a much worse game like Magician Lord.
Whoa, you're going to talk crap about Magician Lord. I haven't played that extensively. Oh, okay. This is going to be interesting because our next episode that's already been recorded, we do get into this stuff a little bit. But my brief impressions are that the console is fantastic. And the really cool thing is that I was able to get Quan Nguyen from arcadeworks.net to come on and to talk about his history with the Neo Geo and how we got into like creating these consoleized MVS machines. And luckily it was just like an email. Like Josh and I were talking off air. It's like, how'd you get the interview? Just like, these are cool people that really love this stuff. Just like us. If you are going to make a consoleized MVS system, you must really love the Neo Geo. And he has a really cool story about how he got into it and his whole background with like developing these electronics and stuff like that. So you can check that out. It will be out on Wednesday. So it's like a kind of like a mini 1 hour side interview that is going to be out there for people. But I'm very happy with it so far. I got to play a bunch of Samurai Showdown 4, which is the best Samurai Showdown because it's incredibly over the top. And
yeah, I watched your video. It's quite good.
The game's so cool. And it's super cheap if you want to get the card. So yeah, that's what I got into as I started going to the various forums and eBay and like, yeah, you know, I got a little bit of credit left on this credit card. Let's just drop some money to make sure we have enough games so I can have people come over and we can play some Neo Geo stuff. So I bought a couple controllers, picked up some, gems like Windjammers is getting nuts. So I was able to find a copy of that for $120 instead of $180. And some of the other classics like Metal Slug and Metal Slug X, which I also bought off of Quan. So It is a cool community, and it's just like one of those things that I've owned three MVS arcade machines in the last couple of years, and this way I can just have no excuse. I have plenty of room for it, and it looks great upscaled through SCART into the Framemeister, so getting my money's worth out of that thing too. So check that out on Wednesday. Josh, you want to talk about Strider?
I do, and I also just want to say I want to come over and play Metal Slug.
I'm telling you, like, this is the thing, Josh. Like, if you come up to Boston, we will do like a live stream, super fun back in my play thing for charity or something.
Yeah, absolutely. There'll be some reason where I'll end up there. So yes, we will do this.
Deal.
Strider. I think this is very relevant to the people who like retro stuff. You've probably heard, I think we talked about it when it was initially announced over the summer, the new Strider game that's going to be sort of a Metroidvania, being made by Double Helix, who most recently did the Killer Instinct game on Xbox One. They have a new Strider coming out in February, so I didn't realize it was coming out this soon until this week when they put out a new trailer. So just a few weeks away, it's going to be on PS4, PS3, 360, and PC, and it looks like it's shaping up really nicely. I was very cautiously optimistic about it all along as a fan of that series and as a fan of Metroidvania games. It's running at 1080p, 60 frames per second on PS4 and PC, for those of you who care about that sort of thing, which I do. I think the game should be fast and they should be smooth. So I'm going to talk about it. I'll buy it the week it comes out, and I'll talk about it on the show next month or sometime after it comes out. But be on the lookout for that. It's looking really good. Strider fans, go check out some footage.
Very cool.
I'm pumped for that. I love the NES Strider, which is the one that is set up more like a Metroid game versus like the arcade version, which is not.
Yeah, which is more linear, certainly. Mm-hmm. But always fun action-oriented gameplay. So, you know, I was going to say I wish it was coming out on Wii U, just seeing as how Nintendo fans have appreciated the Strider series over the years. But it is on a lot of platforms, so hopefully everybody will get to play it.
Josh, I don't know if you saw the news, but no one puts out games for the Wii U anymore.
I saw that, and it's breaking my little heart.
Nintendo puts out, like, two games a year that are really great.
They do, and then I'm going to try not to whine.
No, it's all about positivity here, and that's why we're not going to talk about it. I just said there was a news story this week. So, Johnny, now that, since we have you on, being from a positive Nintendo-centric podcast, I thought it would be cool to talk about hidden gems on the NES, since we're kind of focusing on that today. And you actually are Josh, you brought one up, or actually, we all are. The NES Strider game is a super cool game.
Yes, it is.
I mean, it's not a hidden gem, but it's probably one of those games that people are like, oh, it's not like the awesome 8 megabit arcade version on the Sega Genesis, but it is a kind of an oddity and a cool game within its own right, too.
I think it's a lot more interesting than the Genesis one. The Genesis is kind of a port or a downgrade of the arcade version, I think.
Yeah.
And the NES version is completely different, and because they couldn't do the giant sprite characters and the really fancy action scenes, they made it more about exploration and like nonlinear level design, and and you get upgrades, and you know, if any of this sounds familiar, maybe you get a sense for why I like it. But I played that game a few years ago when I was reviewing. Capcom did a GBA collection called, I think, Capcom Mega Mix. And it had Bionic Commando and Strider and something else all on one cartridge. And so I played through NES Strider again and really enjoyed it again. So I think that game holds up quite well.
It really does, yeah.
Very cool. Any other like hidden gems on the NES that come to mind that you know people could probably snag on eBay?
Oh, geez. One of my all-time favorite NES games has not really seen a whole lot of love in recent years, but it's called Crystalis, and it's a Sunsoft sort of Zelda-like game. But it's a few years after Zelda, and it has very nice graphics and some really, really cool gameplay concepts. But it really does play a lot like Zelda, and I think that's a fantastic game to look up. Also has spectacular music, and it's very challenging, especially later on, but There is a sort of port or remake of it for Game Boy Color that Nintendo Software Technologies made, and I really can't recommend that version. If it's the only way you can play it, go for it. But if you can, if there's any way at all to get your hands on the NES version, that's the one to go for.
That's a good call to bring up with the Neo Geo discussion being from SNK. That's perfect.
Oh, yeah, it was SNK, wasn't it?
Yeah, but it's, you know, it has a lot of, like, the Sunsoft traits, though, to it, too. If you kind of just, like, look at the screens or if you listen to the soundtrack, it definitely is a high-quality game. And it has, you know, it's one of those games that if you are sick of playing The Legend of Zelda for the 100th time, it is a really cool game to pick up and to mess around with this. Definitely, and it's cheap. It's not too expensive. You can get it for – is it on Virtual Console as well?
It is not, unfortunately, no.
Bummer.
I think it's in some kind of rights vortex with the original Japanese developers, so I don't know how likely it is to ever get another release, but it's very, very well worth tracking down.
And, you know, go ahead.
I was just going to mention another one, so if you have something else to say about Chrysalis, please do.
No, it's just dope. Pick it up. It's got a really cool purple label on it. I like it.
Yeah, and it takes place in the far-flung future of 1997.
Yep.
I just wonder what it's gonna be like.
Yeah,
I heard Seinfeld is gonna be on TV. He's gonna have his own TV show.
Nah, I can't see that panning out. But anyway, whatever you say.
Another game I really like. It's quite difficult, but really really cool is called a Fazanadu, and that one is on the Wii Virtual Console. That's a game by Falcom. It's Xanadu is a franchise that Falcom released alongside their Ys series. So if you're a fan of Ys, especially with all the remakes and new games that they've been continuing to pump out in the Ys franchise, Fazanadu is fairly easy to get either on cartridge or on Virtual Console. It's pretty easy to get into, although it is quite challenging. The entire game takes place on this giant tree. And you visit all these different villages that are built into the tree at different levels. And it's a kind of a 2D platformer with a lot of RPG elements. So it's similar to Zelda 2 in some respects. It also, I think, kind of suffers from some translation problems. It's very typical of that era. I wouldn't be too shy about looking for help on it. But you can get pretty far into it. It's a very interesting action game.
I have to ask, do you enjoy difficult games? Are you kind of a Dark Souls guy or like a Spelunky guy?
I've never played Dark Souls. It's tempting, like especially as you continue to hear people harp on about it and people discovering it, even you know a couple years after the first release. You know, it definitely makes me think maybe I should go back and try it. But at this point, I'll probably just wait for the sequel.
Yeah.
You know. It's like it's a little scary for me just because I don't have tons and tons of time to play games anymore. And so I do get frustrated. I do tend to give up more easily now that I'm older. So I have a lot of fondness for really difficult games from my childhood, but I'm not always that eager to try difficult games now. You know, I'm okay with that. I'm honest with myself about it. But I have a lot of respect for difficult games, even though I don't always spend a ton of time with them. But I do love Super Meat Boy, and I enjoy Spelunky. It's not one of my favorites, but I've put some time into it as well.
Very cool. Josh, any games that come to the top of your head when you think of, you know, hidden NES gems?
No.
I get. Are you sure? Does your cat have any?
Yeah. Can you hear him purring still?
Oh, it's cute. It's our, you know, it's like our kids in the background. Sometimes my dog is chewing on stuff and squeaking, and sometimes the cat's purring.
Right. Yeah. Well, and he's just very happy to hear that we're all okay with each other again after that heated discussion on Mylands.
Yeah, man. I almost went to go look for the cart so I could throw it again while we're talking about it.
Yeah. Really break Johnny's heart. I'm sorry.
You can abuse it all you want.
Yeah, use it and abuse it. I didn't look up any gems, and just none are popping out off the top of my head right now.
I put it in there on the like last second of the outline, so it's no worries. I'm gonna keep saying that we got to play some Mick Kids.
Oh, I love MC Kids.
All right, see, here we go. What?
You can run on the ceiling.
All right, here's the deal. Since we did Mylon Secret Castle, you get to come back on the show, and we're going to talk about that.
Okay, but I have to find an NES to play it on because it's not available digitally. But I would love to play it again.
Deal. Deal. Yeah, we'll figure it out. All right.
Let me throw out a couple more real quick since Josh didn't have any.
Yeah, go for it.
I highly recommend Little Nemo, the Dream Master.
Oh, hell yeah.
That probably will never get re-released. It's a licensed game. Mm-hmm. There's a good animated movie of it too, but the NES game is by Capcom. It's absolutely brilliant. Beautiful graphics. And then the other one, this is not that hidden, but I still think there are a lot of people who never played it for whatever reason, but I'm a big fan of Star Tropics.
Huh.
Yeah,
it's a first-party Nintendo game, and it is easy to get.
Yeah, and it's a great game. It holds up really well.
Very weird, but I like weird games, so.
Well, it's an interesting backstory, right? Because that was one of those games that Nintendo specifically made for the U.S. market. Mm-hmm. So it was marketed directly towards us. And I talked about this. I don't know if I talked about it on here or on 8.4, but like there are still brand new copies of that game in Japan that you can buy in like the traders and like the used game shops with the rest of the Famicom games. They actually have copies of Star Tropics and Star Tropics 2 there. Which again, every time I go back there, they still have those copies. So I don't think they're really flying off the shelf.
No, those would be import titles for Japanese gamers.
Well, exactly. They,
they would have no familiarity with those at all.
Wow. It's hard to imagine, but yeah, that's true. Capcom really deserves to be commended for the licensed stuff they were putting out in the NES era. I know a lot of people have talked about this before, but my goodness, like you just think about Little Nemo and Chip and Dale and just so many different DuckTales, you know.
I would have mentioned DuckTales, except they did just do that great remake of it. So it's easy to go play that now. And I think the remake is spectacular. I think it's a great representation of the NES game.
Gorgeous.
So.
We actually covered that on, I think, the second or third episode of the
first episode. Episode one.
Yeah, that's right. After Zelda. Yeah. So if anybody wants to hear Back in My Place take on that game, go check it out.
All right.
Cool. Well, I think that's where we'll kind of wrap things up. Before we toss it off to you, Johnny, just a reminder, I forgot to mention, you can go to youtube.com/backinmyplay. That's where all those weekend rental videos are. And I also did two pretty in-depth videos on the Neo Geo Omega. So if you're interested in this thing, excuse me, I really kind of like talk about it for like a half an hour. So if you want to check that out.
You should go watch those videos. Like they're really helpful. They're making me seriously consider it.
Yeah, and I have a bunch more pre-recorded, including Wonder Boy and Monster World. And what else did I? I did a bunch of PC Engine games too. So there'll be more of those coming down the road. But before we go, Johnny, again, you know, where can people check out your stuff and where are the best places for them to reach you and see what you're doing?
All right. Yeah. So I do host my own podcast called Radio Free Nintendo with three of my very good buddies over at NWR. And we are coming up on our 400th episode this summer. So we've been doing this since 2006. And we really do talk about Nintendo every week. So I can't say that we are always positive because I don't think that's possible if you talk about Nintendo every single week for 8 years. but we do our best. And we really do mix in a lot of retro stuff with it, you know, just because we all grew up with games. And I think for almost any gamer, Nintendo is a part of your childhood probably. So, you know, we don't always do like entire episodes focused on things like, you know, NES or something like that. But we always bring it into the conversation. You know, we're always playing new games. They say it kind of reminds me of this older game. And sometimes we get really obscure and, you know, we all have very different histories. And so we all have different viewpoints on where we come from. And anyway, I think if you enjoy Back in My Play, you will probably get a big kick out of Radio Free Nintendo. And you know, pretty often we do have, you know, feature segments where we, you know, literally just play an old game and talk about it. It's very similar to what you guys do here. So I hope people will check that out. Like I said, the F-Zero X and GX episode should already be out. So that's a good place to start if you're primarily interested in older games. I also am on a couple other podcasts I could bring up here. I do a movie show called Box Office Poison, And we've been doing that for like 3 or 4 years now, but it's a very similar format. It's very casual. We get into a very wide variety of movies, like big blockbusters and like really obscure, like indie foreign stuff. And we just kind of mash it all together. And we have really fun conversations about it. We just did our top five list of 2013, which really turned out to be a huge episode and with a lot of really good discussion on it. So that's over at crosstalk.com with a W. And then my own show that I host and produce over there about music, and that's called Discover Music Project. And it's all about helping people learn more about musicians that they've probably heard of but don't really know very much about. That's kind of a pet project of mine. I do about one episode a month. And each episode is focused on, you know, one particular band or sometimes like kind of a niche subgenre, we've done death metal and minimalism and stuff like that. So, if you're interested in music, and especially if you're interested in like learning about music that you haven't really been exposed to very much, I think you'll enjoy that too. And that's also over at crosstalk.com with a W.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't know about the music podcast. I knew you did the film thing, but I didn't know about the music one. So,
please check it out. It's very, very special to me, and it's been great for me because as much as it's an opportunity for me to introduce my favorite music to other people, it's also a way for my friends and people who listen to the show to introduce music to me. So I've learned a tremendous amount from doing it, and hopefully I've been able to turn back some of that back to the audience as well.
Very cool. Yeah. Well, I just want to say, this is Josh speaking. I've listened to Radio Free Nintendo for several years. I talked about this yesterday when I was a guest on the show, and always knew that I wanted to have Johnny on the show at some point in time on Back in My Play. So thank you to Kevin for the outlet, and thank you to Johnny for being on. It was really, really cool to have you on and just to experience this depth of Nintendo knowledge firsthand. So you did a great job.
Thanks, man. It's an honor to be invited to the show.
Before we wrap up, you talked about your top movies of 2013. Obviously, the top of the list was Fast and Furious 6, right?
That was probably the bottom of the list.
Oh.
Was it like a reverse order list, you mean? Like where actually
I wish I had my webcam on with my beautifully framed posters of Tokyo Drift and Fast and Furious 6 behind me right now, because this is just piercing my heart. Very cool. For before we wrap up, we do have a lineup kind of locked in for the next month.
Oh, yeah.
Like I said, that episode with Quan Nguyen is going to be coming up midweek. This weekend or a week from now, we're going to be having Steve Lin on the show to talk about game collecting, video game auctions, preservation, and possibly Bonk's Adventure. And then after that, we have Mike Micah coming on to also talk about crazy game collecting, auctions, and stuff like that, video game history. Brian Davis from Next Level Games has gotten the okay to come on, so he's working on a game.
Brian's great.
Speaking of Nintendo, yeah.
Brian's been one of our biggest kind of like, pushers on Twitter and stuff like that. So I am super pumped to get him on. And we're obviously, I think all three of us are really big fans of what they do over there at Next Level Games. So that's going to be great. And also Lloyd Parker, the designer of our logo, is going to be coming on to talk about Sonic the Hedgehog. And we are in talks with a couple other people, and it's been super awesome. Everyone, again, from Johnny and from Kurt and CJ and Greg, everyone that has, agreed to come on and talk about old games. It's been a huge pleasure to talk to everyone, and it's kind of, like I said, just a real pleasure to talk to you guys. It's what drives us to do this podcast every week. So thank you. So Johnny, again, like Josh said, thank you so much for coming on, and we'll definitely have to have you on again down the road to talk about some more games.
Excellent. It was truly my pleasure.
Awesome. Okay. Thanks so much, everyone. Josh, you want to final words?
Yeah. Johnny and I, by the way, I didn't know this. I just think everybody should know this, though. I didn't know this when I invited him to be on the show, but I figured it out over time. We're both Auburn University graduates, so I just wanted to say War Eagle.
War Eagle.
Must there be weird to have gone to a college that matters. Keene State does not come up a lot. Weird.
Well, yeah. There's not a lot going on in the state of Alabama, so sure. The universities are definitely like the claim to fame.
Very cool.
Okay.
Thanks, everyone. We'll see you next time.
Peace.
Bye-bye.